It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. No Child Left Behind, the fundamental legislation underlying public education in this country, was signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2002. It was a reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. Now, 50 years after the original act, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, including Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey, is working to rewrite the No Child Left Behind Act. It is the first attempt to make major changes to the act since it was passed 13 years ago. Joining us today to talk about education policy and the No Child Left Behind rewrite effort is Lily Eskelson Garcia, president of the Educators Labor Union, the National Education Association. Lily Eskelson Garcia, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
I'm honored to be here, Paul. Thank you for having me on.
The original Elementary and Secondary Education Act was passed in 1965 under President Lyndon Johnson. What was the character of the ECEA, and why did lawmakers decide in the early 2000s that changes were needed?
Very good questions. You get an A-plus for good questions.
Well, thank you.
My sixth graders, they got one jelly bean for a good answer. They got two jelly beans for a good question. So it's a two jelly bean question because we are actually celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which was signed by President Lyndon Johnson in 1965 as part of his war on poverty. This was part of the civil rights movement, where in the 60s, where you were still desegregating schools, children who lived in high poverty areas, children who lived in communities that still faced dire discrimination, were not being served equally with their more affluent counterparts in other neighborhoods. And so the federal government, for the first time, stepped in and said, we are going to give some extra help to those high poverty schools, funding for reading tutors in what are called Title I schools, teacher training, some technology, English language learners got some extra help. And the NEA would charge up Capitol Hill every 10 years when ESEA was being reauthorized, and we could lobby with one single word, more. We actually just said, can you just give us more of that good stuff, because these kids come to us with so little. And then in 2002, as you mentioned, they changed the name to No Child Left Behind, and with great bipartisan fanfare, proceeded to take away all the good stuff that we needed, all of the extra resources and help for those kids that lived in poverty. And they replaced it with a national test and punish and label kids by a standardized test score. And that's what we've lived with now for 13 years. It's time for us to go back to the roots of ESEA, to the civil rights roots, and start talking about where are the resource gaps, the program and services gaps between kids who have so much and they need so much, and kids that have so little and they need just as much.
So my next question was going to be about those changes and revisions that were made in No Child Left Behind. As far as what occurred in terms of the revisions, in your estimation, how did the character of the policy then change?
You know, instead of this focus on saying there are kids in schools and communities that really do need extra help, they come to school. I taught at a homeless shelter for years. I know kids whose families are struggling, and kids that come to school not having not only breakfast, they didn't eat the night before. So it really was a wonderful thing that President Johnson did to say, let's give those schools something extra to help those kids. What changed in 2002 when politicians, most of whom have never stood in front of 39 fifth graders the way I have, when politicians got their hands on it and said, oh, all we need to know are some standardized test scores, and then we'll just shame them, name them, blame them. If you don't get your test scores up, then you're a bad student. You're a bad school. And it was harming our kids. It is harming our kids. And I think after 13 long years suffering under No Child Left Untested, Congress itself actually is really highly motivated to get something done on this. They realize what a mistake it was in 2002 to have this standardized one-size-fits-all punishment for kids. And they need to hear from the public, from parents, from educators who know the names of the students that they love. Now's the time to let your voice be heard.
And we've often heard that criticism that when No Child Left Behind emphasizes teaching to the test, that it's not necessarily serving the best interests of the students. And you made an interesting statement just a moment ago about how none of the people who have created this legislation have, or at least most of them, have not stood up in front of students as you have. So would you agree that that's the problem?
I think the problem is always going to occur when you have politicians or bureaucrats or even CEOs of major corporations. Who knows? Just about everybody I've ever met has an opinion about public schools. But when and some of them are really good ideas, and some of them are horrible ideas. But when you have a politician and a group of politicians, remember, this was passed with bipartisan fanfare on both sides of the aisle. They got together without one classroom teacher there to guide them. So you had all of these politicians without adult supervision deciding, here's what we'll do. This is simple. Whenever there's someone that says, here's a simple answer for a very complex problem, and poverty amongst our students is a growing problem. And they say, just give them a standardized test, tell those schools to get the test scores up somehow, and then we're done. That's all we need to do. It's why we're in such a horrible mess. The good news is, a lot of the folks that voted for that 13 years ago are no longer in Congress. A lot of the folks that will be voting for this are new people who are hearing from Republican and Democratic governors, Republican and Democratic state legislators, Republican and Democratic mommies and daddies, who are saying, this doesn't make any sense. Do something that actually works to help these kids. And so we have an opportunity because more and more members of Congress might have an open mind about ending this test and punish routine and replacing it with better information. By the way, I gave my kids lots of tests. I needed to know how my kids were doing. But the least important test I gave them all year long was that one standardized test at the end of the year, usually didn't get the results back till the last day of school sometimes, and it was to give a very general overview of how the school was doing. You certainly wouldn't tell a third grader they couldn't go to fourth grade based on one standardized test you gave in the spring. That's actually happening in places like Oklahoma now. So the testing has taken on a life of its own. It's led to absurdities, and now's our chance from the federal level to do something right for kids.
And the absurdity that you, or absurdities that you mentioned, are you including in that the situation that just occurred in Atlanta where teachers were found guilty of changing students' test scores?
Oh, the kinds of corruption that have happened because of teaching to the test and prizes and punishments based on the test are all over the map. And so if you are going to have high-stakes punishments for not hitting cut scores on a test, you bet it's going to affect test scores.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and our guest is Lily Eskelson-Garcia, president of the Educators Labor Union, the National Education Association. Miss Lily, as your students used to call you. Our own Senator Bob Casey is part of an effort in the Senate to rewrite No Child Left Behind. What are some of the big changes that this rewrite effort is trying to put into place?
We are looking to end that one-size-fits-all testing, replace it with a dashboard of better success indicators and resource indicators. Are all kids getting what they need? Shouldn't the public know that? And if you want to reach your senator, both senators and your member of Congress, you can go up to a website, getesearight.com, put in your zip code. It will connect you with your members of Congress, and you can write your story what you want your senator to do, whether you're a parent, a grandparent, or an educator. Let them hear your voice so that they will get it right this time.
Lily Eskelson-Garcia is president of the Educators Labor Union, the National Education Association. Lily Eskelson-Garcia, thanks so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Coming up, we'll talk with an expert about why your child needs to be technologically fluent. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We often hear about people losing their jobs as a result of robotics or artificial technology, but is there anything you can do to help prevent job loss in the future? Ela Norbash is a professor at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute. He's written a book that encourages parents to help their kids plan for a future when work and careers will be transformed by high tech. Ela Norbash joins us to talk about his book entitled Parenting for Technology Futures. Welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh, Ela.
It's a pleasure to be here, Paul.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh at wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. You may have questions about how to make your children tech fluent, and you may be wondering why you should. Share your ideas, thoughts, and questions with us at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Ela Norbash, your new book is a follow-up from your previous book, Robot Futures, which is about how robots and artificial intelligence may displace certain kinds of work. What led you to decide that a follow-up about parenting specifically was needed?
You know, when I published Robot Futures and started talking about the issues in that book, everybody kept asking me about unemployment and underemployment and how the future is a future in which robots will take over more and more of the kinds of jobs we do and we hope our children do. The number one question I got was from parents, parents of kindergartners, middle schoolers. The question was, what do I do to prepare my children for this future where automation is all around us? How do they become the person who can work in that environment, who can make ends meet? And so it occurred to me that what we know inside the university in studying technology fluency and how children take technology and create the future, if they're given the right tools, that knowledge ethically has to go out to parents all over Pittsburgh so that anybody knows what they can do with their kids to prepare them for this very unusual future we're going to face.
And let's talk about that. This book is about raising kids to be technologically fluent. What does that mean? How exactly would you define what it means to be technologically fluent?
You know, we often talk about technology literacy, and most of our kids, including mine, can program my cell phone. They can make it program its ringer better than I can. That's not technologically fluency. That's knowing how to use technology, being a user and a consumer. And if you get real good at programming a VCR or downloading apps and running them, all you've become is a really good technology consumer. Technology fluency is all about fluency, which is communication. Can your child learn to communicate something they deeply believe, something they care about, and use technology as a portal for doing that? That's what you do every day on this program, by communicating out. And that's what kids do if they create a blog, if they create a photo stream. If they create something they care about and take technology and turn it from something you consume into something with which you produce.
And you've just outlined things that exist today. What might we see in the future? I mean, and I know you don't have a crystal ball sitting in front of you, but you've studied this. So what would, let's say somebody has a child who is 5 today and they're wondering what is going to be happening when they're 25. What do you see out there for them?
What we're seeing as trends across not just this nation but the whole world is that any kind of standard job that has ritual cognitive or ritual physical load, so if you're moving boxes from point A to point B, if you're stocking a warehouse, or if you're doing somebody's taxes for them, so the cognitive side and the physical side, anything that we can program smarter and smarter computers to do, that's what computers are going to do for us. And the odd part about it is it's not about computers being better than we are. You know, when you go through the automated checkout counter at Giant Eagle, it's mediocre. It takes time to get your fruit through that system. But they still implement that at Giant Eagle because it's cheaper. So we will face mediocre technology that will take away cognitive and physical labor from us. And so what you need to do as a standout is prepare your child to be inventive and creative, to use technology like a paintbrush.
It seems safe to say that young people today are, you know, they use a lot of technology. You're saying that, you know, as you mentioned before, that just because you're proficient at using the technology that is currently available doesn't make you tech fluent. So it's about using the technology to get your message out or to use it as a conveyor of whatever skill that you have. What are some of the broader-based ideas about how technology possibly can and will be used in the future?
One way to look at it is technology is going to change very quickly. I remember going to a kindergarten a couple of years ago where they were teaching children how to use a mouse. And that was a really depressing place because they're teaching them how to use a technology that won't exist when that child is 12 years old. So technology moves so fast that you're not learning even to use a technology. You're learning how to learn about technology. You're learning how to be so good at being flexible and inventive and creative and problem solve around technology that when a new kind of computer interface comes out, you're going to be the one who's at the head of the pack learning how to uncover its details. And in a way, that enthusiasm, that idea of learning to learn, is something you can gain from any parent who spends time with their child. It doesn't even require the parent to be technologically proficient. What it requires is enthusiasm and engagement. And one interesting study that came out about this was powerful because it showed that when you use digital tutors to learn online, they don't change your attitudes about learning. If you already have a good attitude about learning math, your digital math tutor will teach you math. But if you don't have a good attitude, the needle doesn't move at all. You need that human interaction to move the attitudinal needle before you're ready to use the technology to further your future.
And when you talk about how the parents don't necessarily need to be technologically fluent themselves to, you know, help their kids achieve this, you might have addressed some of the trepidations that people have because it seems like as people hear this, they might be a little bit frightened. They might be saying, you know, oh my God, I'm behind, or I've been thinking about all the wrong things, or, you know, my assumption that my child who is always on his or her cell phone or iPhone or Droid or computer or iPad, whatever it happens to be, that because they're doing all these things and they're interacting in this way, that they're going to be ready. And now all of a sudden there's a rethink to this.
There's a couple of very concrete things parents can do that work really well. One is just pure participation. If your child is learning how to use an online tool, sit with them and learn with them, especially if you don't know how to use it. If they're using Khan Academy and the schools assign them to use Khan Academy, get on there with them. You're going to not just learn math, you're going to learn that your child can be a teacher. And that puts the child in a whole new role with the parent that makes them really powerful because it realizes for them that through technology, they can become a knowledge broker. Another really simple
Is that maybe a little disconcerting for parents because might they be reluctant to put themselves, to engage a child in that way because they're putting themselves in a situation where the child is going to realize that I have some power, you know, over my parent, that they may even think, hey, you know, dad's not that bright, is he? Because I know, I'm showing him what to do.
Actually, it's scarier than that. We have a whole lot of kids who spend 10, 20, 30 hours a week on that screen of that iPad, and the parents have no idea what they're doing on that screen. They could be doing anything. Mm. If you put yourself next to them, you learn about their world. They become a teacher, and instead of you invading their space, instead of you being a spy, you become somebody who's collaborating with them. You become shoulder to shoulder with them. That's very powerful for them. It's empowering, actually. The other side is decidedly non-technological, but just as important. If you like cars, take your kids to the car show all the time. what happens is they develop an excitement and an interest about how you can tell different models of cars apart, how you learn how a turbocharger works and how a hybrid engine works. Anytime you give a child an island of expertise, whatever it's about, from fly fishing to car shows, they develop expertise and learn that learning is exciting. And they will parlay that into technology, because then they're going to go on Google. They're going to do a Google search on different kinds of cars. They're going to take a digital camera and make a gallery of the coolest cars they've seen. So you want to make excitement and enthusiasm out of a topic and then teach them how they can take technology and produce media around that topic they care about.
We're talking with Ila Norbash, who is the author of a new book about technology and how to make your children tech fluent. If you have a comment or question for our guest, 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002 to join the conversation. Again, the book is titled Parenting for Technology Futures, and you may have questions about how to make your children tech fluent. You may be wondering why you should. Again, there is this balance, which we'll get into, that some parents are concerned about, balancing the child's desire to be engaged with technology and also the idea of unplugging, just so children know what that's like. Share your ideas, your thoughts, and feedback with us at 412-246-2002. Again, our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, on Twitter at ESS. And let's talk about this sort of give and take this fine line that parents find themselves walking with their kids, knowing that they want to make them tech fluent, but at the same time that they want to have them unplug, disconnect from all the tech devices, which doesn't seem like a bad idea. So how do you balance that?
You know, we all face this danger of the technological echo chamber. There's this fact of the matter that we can spend time with technology, like the internet, in such a way that all it does is reinforce the beliefs we already have and reinforce the interests we already have. So you like Lord of the Rings, and you end up spending all of your time on websites related to Lord of the Rings. What that doesn't do is broaden you. It doesn't show you that you can dive deep into a scientific or technical subject and learn enough that you can uncover new things about yourself, new talents that you didn't know you even had. So the trick about unplugging is unplugging lets us reset. It lets us get out of the echo chamber and look around. And it might mean volunteering at the Pittsburgh parks and learning how to disambiguate different kinds of plants from each other so you know which ones to pull out of the ground. But when you've done that, now you can go get the iPad app that lets you identify plants from their tree shapes and leaf patterns. And so now you can bring technology back into that outside interest. Car show, again, it unplugs you from that echo chamber and allows you to look with your own eyes and explore and essentially be a scientist again, be somebody who observes the world and cares about the world. That issue of unplugging and then replugging, it's really a pendulum. You have to do both. But there's something I encourage parents to do. It's called making a producer-consumer table. And this helps a lot with understanding what's happening online. Make a table.
A producer-consumer table.
Yes. So you make a table with your child. You sit down with your child, and even a five-year-old can do this with you real well. You list all the activities they do on screen media, whether it's a television set or an iPad or an iPhone or a Kindle. And you put them in three columns. Is it producing, consuming, or interacting? Producing, that's when they're creating something new. Are they writing a blog, creating a photo gallery? Are they writing a story up or publishing a poem? Consuming, that's when all you're doing is sitting there passively. You've seen the faces of your children when they do this. Mm. You're looking and you're in receive mode. Your mouth can hang open and all you're doing is accepting information, just like the old-fashioned TV that we grew up with. And interactive, it's a little bit of both, like Khan Academy or Instructables.com, where you're learning new skills, you're learning how to make silly putty, then you're running to the kitchen, you're making some silly putty. That's actually producing. That's pretty awesome. So make that list. If you are about even, if you have, 10 activities in producing and 10 activities in consuming, fine. You have a great balance. But you should be worried if you have 20 activities and they're all consuming and nothing else.
Mm. 412-246-2002, the number to call to join our conversation with Dr. Ila Norbash. Let's go to John in Pittsburgh. John, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, I heard this program starting in Pittsburgh. in the schools, and it's called STEAM. Have you heard something about it? STEAM stands for science, technology, and something else, whatever.
And Ela is nodding. He knows what you're talking about, John. So why don't you go ahead and address that?
John, that's a great question. We have to start by explaining what STEM is and then dive into STEAM. STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. And I actually write all about the politics of STEM in my book because huge amounts of federal funding are now devoted to this idea that our kids need to know about science, technology, engineering, math. Now, there's a problem here, which is a lot of schools implement this by making what we call silos. They make sure you have a technology class and you learn technology in your technology class, and you have a separate math class and a separate engineering class. And the problem with that approach is only the kids who care about each of those individual topics pay any attention in the tech class, for instance. STEAM is a major improvement. It is a major improvement on STEM because it adds art, science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Of course, you can ask the question, what about English, civics, history, poetry, everything else that we care about in life? And the answer is, we have a faddish society. We like to pick something and say, oh, that's the problem. Let's focus on that. The problem isn't any one of these disciplines. And STEAM is better than STEM, make no mistake. But the problem is we don't integrate the lessons. We need classes in schools that combine science and technology with English and art and math at the same time. We have a whole program called Arts and Bots we've been deploying to Pittsburgh Public and AIU, for instance, from the Create Lab, where kids in poetry class build a robot that represents what that poem means to them. That's what you want to do, because now they're communicating with a robot about a creative subject. And that shows them that they can be creative, they can have an opinion, and that opinion can count.
412-246-2002 if you have a comment or question for our guest, Dr. Ela Norbash. And again, he's written a book for parents that addresses how to make their children more tech fluent. And our email address is esspgh@wesa.fm, on Twitter at esspgh. The book entitled Parenting for Technology Futures. When you're talking about some of these things, I can't help but feel that less well-off families who might not have smartphones or internet access might be at a disadvantage. Is it tougher for some families to help kids become tech fluent?
It's absolutely tougher, but at the same time, the number one thing that we need to realize is that the parents need to recognize that their participation is absolutely critical. The only time your kids can become truly tech fluent is when parents and teachers stop outsourcing education to others. We can't sit the child in front of a video game, and expect them to truly learn from that video game. But when we collaborate with our teacher, when we go into that parent-teacher meeting and ask, what can I do at home to help? There are many things you can do at home that don't require wealth, and they don't even require an internet connection, that involve teaching your children the love of learning and becoming a really good respondent to their education, having them practice on you before they go and make a speech at school, for instance. So what we find time and time again is that poverty is a major problem, especially because the pyramid of life means you're focusing on things like shelter and food. And without good nutrition, without good night's sleep, the children can't learn. They're physically unable to learn. And we have to solve those problems. That's on us. That's on society. But once you've overcome those barriers, whether you're wealthy or not, whether you have a car, whether you have a computer at home, that's not what you need for technology fluency. You need the love of learning, and you need to take everything you care about and show the children that you have why you care, why you deep dived into knowledge as you were a kid. You know, we have grandmothers who are incredible at braiding. When they teach a child how to braid, they create mathematical recipes in that child's head, because braiding the right way is just like math, and cooking the right way is just like computer programming. So when you bring your child into your kitchen, go to the library and get a new book on cooking. You don't make the same old stuff, but you get a new book on cooking at the library. You try a new recipe, and you put the child in charge with you. They're learning how to follow directions, how to create recipes, and they're doing math all along the way when they convert pints to cups and cups to four people.
You mentioned something earlier about how you were in this kindergarten class where the teacher was showing the kids how to use a mouse and how depressing that was because 20 years from now, we won't need the mouths. It'll be a thing of the past, just like a rotary dial telephone is. But But how do you predict? I mean, you can see what is going to be phased out at some point, but how do you predict what's going to happen? You know, some of these ideas about how the nature of work that you're addressing, how the nature of work will change in the future, you can anticipate it and even try to predict it, but aren't the social effects of technology sometimes hard to predict?
Absolutely, they're hard to predict, but there's a couple of trends that we can be sure of. One trend, no matter what kind of work your child does when they grow up 20, 30 years from now, they will be using computer devices to do it. They will not be sitting in an office that doesn't have a computer. And what's more, they won't simply be using computer devices. If they have a job, it's because they manipulate the computer, because they program that computer. They create scripts for that computer. They change the way it operates. That's the creative class of the future. So everything that you can do to prepare for that means having your children learn to code, having your children learn what it means not just to use a program on a computer, but to change the way the computer works. And that's critical.
Let's go to Jim in Harmer Township. Jim, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. I just wanted to comment that your guest's theories, and I haven't read anything he's written, but your guest's theories he's spoken about so far do in fact work. And I just spent the last 18 years raising my own son, who's now a college freshman, extraordinarily computer savvy. I never know what he's doing. He writes code in five different languages. He's always been ahead of the curve, very smart. But you're part of your, I'm sorry if it's a book or an article you've written, but it has to do with parenting this technology savviness into a kid. And parenting, I think, is the key word, because not only is my son very tech savvy, we allowed him to explore, of course, while we were looking over his shoulder, but we also got involved in his life outside and away from the screen, as you say. He is an Eagle Scout. He spent 12 years in the Boy Scouts. Not only can he write code, he can light a fire and live on his own and survive outdoors if he has to. So that mix is very possible, but without his mom and I right there, it doesn't happen. Parenting is really the key in my eyes.
Jim, you're exactly right. Parenting is the key, and the parents' relationship, whether you know homeschooled at home with the parents or in the case of formal schooling, the parents' relationship with the teachers is just as important. And part of it is we're creating well-rounded kids because we don't know what the future heralds. And I made my heart bleed when STEM came out because they lost art. Mm. And it's so important that our kids are creative because it is creativity that is hardest for a computer to emulate.
Well, we've talked about this before, but it's the arts that sometimes make a student better at math.
That's
and
right.
Science. Thanks very much for that call, Jim. You know, it seems like there's already so much pressure placed on kids between things like sports, getting good grades, doing extracurricular activities. Do you feel it's possible to put too much pressure on kids, Ela, by talking and thinking about career stuff years in advance?
Absolutely, yes. I see a whole lot of that kind of tiger mom parenting that I believe is very dangerous. And it's dangerous because, you know, there's a whole theory called Project Zero out of Harvard University. We have a number of projects here, like Children's Innovation Project here in Pittsburgh, that emulate a lot of the values about that. It's about slow learning. If you want kids to develop deep interests, you have to give them time. That means they need the space to develop hobbies, to select some of them and to throw away other ones, and then to go down the route, the pathway of that hobby over the course of time with the luxury of no pressure. When we overschedule our kids so that every single evening they have activities, and when they don't have activities, they have to finish the homework for the next morning, you'll lose from them this whole thing that we had growing up, which is time. Time to take a stick and push ants around in the field. Time to think about stamp collecting, go to the library, check out books on stamp collecting, and see if we care about it or not. And when we lose that time, we'll become superficially good at everything, and that will never give us the depth of experience that shows us how we can be self-motivated. And so I think parents have to watch out for that. You have to create space for your child. You can't go to every birthday party that you've been invited to all weekend long because you will never have time for your child to reflect and to explore and to come into their own.
His book is called Parenting for Technology Futures. We've been talking with Ela Norbash. He's a professor at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute. Thank you so much for joining us again here in Studio A today. We appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Plum.
Coming up, we'll introduce you to one of the nation's top 10 college presidents and find out what he has to say about getting more minorities into STEM fields. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. According to USA Today, the workforces at America's biggest tech companies are only about 7% African-American. But Freeman A. Hrabowski III, president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, is trying to change that. President Hrabowski will be in Pittsburgh to deliver the keynote address at a conference entitled Strength in Numbers, Diversifying the STEM Workforce, being hosted by Robert Morris University's Usuri Think Tank. A mathematician, civil rights activist, and researcher in science and math education, Dr. Hrabowski joins us to talk about encouraging minorities toward careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. Freeman Hrabowski, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. I'm honored to be talking with you.
Well, likewise. Dr. Hrabowski, you have what you call a four-pillar approach to education. Explain that for us, if you would.
Well, you know, I gave that TED Talk and talked about the challenges that we face and what it will take to have more students succeeding in science, and technology, engineering, and math. And perhaps the most important thing for me to say is that people know that most minorities who begin with a major in science don't succeed. But what they don't know is that most students of any race who begin in college with a major in science or engineering will not succeed, and that often some of the most best prepared students don't succeed. And this has to do with our expectations, quite frankly, at every level. We tend to think that it's okay for students not to succeed. And so the idea of having high expectations, both of students but also of ourselves, and in K-12 and in the universities, will be very, very important. And that what that means is that we should be expecting that we can do a better job as math teachers, as science teachers, as engineering teachers in connecting the students to the work, that we can teach students what they have to do to have very high expectations, that we can look at the most important strategies, the most effective ways of students succeeding. At UMBC, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, we have focused heavily on collaborative active learning and the use of technology and coupling that type of strategy with these high expectations, and then giving students opportunities to get involved in the research. If you're talking about creating scientists, you have to have them working with scientists. It takes researchers to produce researchers. Students need hands-on experiences, whether they're in middle school or at the university level.
During the 20th century, we had the Great Migration, when millions of African Americans from the rural South moved north to places like Detroit, Cleveland, and here in Pittsburgh for industrial jobs. How do you think that the current situation compares to that historical example where minorities were able to land these good jobs?
Right. Keep in mind, these good jobs, as you call them, were jobs that did help people take care of their families, but these were not jobs that required a college education. In that period, and all the way up until the early 60s, quite frankly, fewer than 5% of African Americans actually had graduated from college, but only about 11% of whites had graduated from college, but one didn't have to have a college degree to get a good job and take care of the family. I'm from Birmingham, and my father actually left education, being a teacher, to work in the steel mill because he could make more money working at a factory than he could as a teacher, sadly. What am I saying? I'm saying that years ago, one could get a job in a factory and make a good living even without a college degree. Today, one needs 2- and 4-year degrees in order to get good jobs, more and more. And increasingly, students need some exposure to technology in all types of jobs. Doesn't mean that the arts and humanities aren't important, but we do see many more jobs requiring more and more grounding in technology-related areas. And unfortunately, we don't see large numbers of minority students, African-Americans and Hispanics, in those disciplines. But I'm going to say again, quite frankly, that we don't see large numbers of Americans in those disciplines. In fact, I chaired the National Academy's Committee on Underrepresentation in Science and Engineering, and what you find is that only about 5% of 25-year-olds in America have degrees in STEM disciplines, compared to twice that percentage in Europe. And for minorities, blacks and Hispanics, it's closer to 2%.
So, I mean, we hear a lot about educational disparity. How do we address the the challenges that historically have existed when it comes to accessing quality education. If you are a as it's called, minority in this country, and you know, the tech industry is emphasizing a set of highly specialized and elite skills, and you don't have access to a quality education, what needs to be done to fix that?
Well, there are many levels of concerns and strategies, on the other hand, that can be used. People are always surprised when I'm talking about increasing the number of students who can succeed in math and science, when I say, as a math person, as a math teacher, that the first skills I'm looking for will be reading and thinking. Because if you give me a child who can read and think well, I can teach her to solve word problems. We don't discuss problems in engineering or in medicine or in science in numbers. We discuss problems in words. And this is why the humanities and social sciences are very important. I mean, for many reasons. I mean, they're important in their own right. But learning to read and think well and write well and communicate well will be important across the board in all disciplines. And the first problem I see with so many American children of all races, particularly those in that bottom 40% socioeconomically, will be that they don't learn to read and think well, to think critically. And when talking about preparing students for careers in STEM, we have to develop their thinking skills, their reading and thinking skills. And so I would argue that we need to be doing much more at those early years, in those early years, to work on those. And we need to be doing much more to support teachers in teaching them the connections between language skills and math skills. As we work to develop the ability of children as they move towards middle school and high school, as Bob Moses, the civil rights activist and math teacher, will tell you, algebra is a fundamental civil right, should be considered a civil right in America. And what that means is that, quite frankly, you can't do anything in terms of upper-level STEM if you don't get that strong algebra preparation in middle school through maybe the ninth grade, because everything else, the calculus, the chemistry, the physics, will be word problems, and you need that background going back all the way to math and reading in the early years.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Freeman A. Hrabowski III. He is president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's coming to Pittsburgh to talk about how he is engaging in efforts to encourage minorities toward careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. So let's say, Dr. Hrabowski, we get the skills in place. This is more than just a skills issue, though, isn't it? And more than just an education issue. And I say that because we've heard criticisms of the Silicon Valley culture being sexist and racist. Do you think that there's something about the culture making the tech world inhospitable to minorities?
I think there's something about the tech world that will show that there are very few people from those populations in that environment. I see my students going into those environments. I mean, my students of color, my white students, my students from other countries, and doing well. And they will say there are very few there. I think there are a lot of wonderful people in those environments who simply have not been around people of color, for example, because you just don't have large numbers of kids coming out in computer science who are getting into those environments. I think there's the need for a more proactive approach on the part of companies across the country to reach out to support students in becoming well-prepared. UMBC is a campus that has students from 150 countries. We like to talk about both international and domestic diversity. So my black and Hispanic kids are working with kids from China and from India, from Russia, wherever, and they're learning. They're learning how to work in cybersecurity and how to work in biochemistry. And what's interesting is that as they learn what's most important, number one is this notion of good thinking and really hard work. You learn that you have to put in hours and hours and hours. You learn how to work with other people. You learn how to ask good questions. You learn how you never give up and how to be persistent. And then, most important, you need the exposure. And so we are sending large numbers of students not only out to California but to other parts of the country and in this region. We actually have 120-plus companies on campus, biotech and IT companies, where large numbers of students, hundreds hundreds of students are working all the time, and from the involvement with the intelligence community to involvement in defense to involvement with biotech companies. And the key is exposure, whether it's in the California area, up in your area, or here in the Baltimore, Washington corridor. When students get the exposure and they're able to do well in classwork, which is a big if. You've got to work to get them to do well in that first 2 years of the science work, after having the right preparation in K-12. And then when they have the exposure in labs or in companies to learn how you work with other people, how you understand the connections between what you get in the classroom and what actually happens in the real world, all things are possible, and they will be able to do it out in California. I do think that broadly, it's not just the companies in California, that broadly the corporate world can do more and more to reach out to help pull students of all types into those environments. It's not just California. We're talking about an American issue that we need to be as competitive as possible by connecting. But I would say the same thing for those of us in universities. We can be doing much more, whether it's in Baltimore or Pittsburgh, to reach out and work with teachers and children to prepare them well so they can succeed in our institutions.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Hrabowski, about your extraordinary life. You have been named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Talk about what that's like.
I have no idea what that means.
What does it mean to you?
I should tell your listeners, if it's true, my name is Hrabowski, and yeah, they probably can tell. I am African American. My great great grandfather was Polish in the Deep South. Was a slave master, and I grew up in the civil rights movement. Had the privilege of marching with children in the Children's March under Dr. King, and spent a week in jail because we wanted a better education. And
right,
and was
right. I mean,
very fortunate to have wonderful. Wonderful parents who were teachers, had been teachers, and as I said, my father had left teaching to make more money. But in a home where there were books and religion was important, the traditional American home in a society that wanted to tell me I was second class, but where my community and my church and my school said, if you work hard and you do your best, all things are possible. As tough as segregation might have been in Birmingham, I would say I wish every child could have had the privilege of having two wonderful parents who put education and their child first and who believe in the significance of faith and education and hard work. And that was my upbringing. And so I have a book coming out in the next few weeks, and it focuses on empowering youth from the civil rights movement to STEM achievement.
And I don't want to just gloss over that you know, people might be saying, did I hear that right? When he was 12 years old, he was jailed after, you know, taking part as a youth advocate in a civil rights march. And yes, in fact, you were, and you were incarcerated for 5 days. And unfortunately, we have less than a minute left. But, you know, to go from that to then graduating from college at 19, receiving your doctorate at 24, what allowed you to be so determined and resolute?
I was very fortunate to have strong Christian family at the heart, with really hardworking parents and teachers who kept telling me nothing takes the place of hard work and dreaming about the possibilities. I was just a fortunate American child who happened to be a little black nerdy kid in Birmingham, Alabama, who's now fortunate to be president of UMBC, a place that has students from all over the world who are aspiring to be artists and scientists.
And again, we should mention that you will be appearing at Robert Morris University's Usuri Think Tank as one of the speakers encouraging minorities toward careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. Our guest has been Dr. Freeman A. Hrabowski III. He is president of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and we appreciate your taking the time to talk to us here on Essential Pittsburgh, and we look forward to your keynote address at the conference entitled Strength in Numbers, Diversifying the STEM Workforce. Dr. Hrabowski,
thank you, Paul.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to talk to you, and I look forward to being in your city.
Likewise. Thank you so much, sir.
Okay. Bye now.
Tomorrow on Essential Pittsburgh, we'll look at the debate over the use of psychiatric medications to treat children and young adults. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.